the Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. The views expressed on the Financial Cafe are those of the hosts and do not represent the views of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, the SIU Board of Trustees, or WSIE Radio. Securities offered through Nickel Investors Corporation at No. 1 Executive Park, Granite City, Illinois, member FINRA and SIPC.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
I'd be rich.
And now, welcome to the Financial Cafe and our hosts, Larry Lexo and John Graney.
Good morning, John Graney.
Good morning, Larry Lexo. How are we doing today?
Absolutely wonderful.
If I was any better, I'd be you, Larry.
Yeah, you can only hope. So what's on our agenda for today, John?
Well, before we get to the agenda for today, I wanted to say I had fun having Nancy in from Chef Shop last week.
I think that was awesome.
So that was good, and we'll be doing more of that, more interviews with people in our community and so forth. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, good time was had by all.
Yeah, some good laughs.
So if our listeners out there, if you have someone that you think would both be interested and be a good fit to come on board and talk about one of the topics, you know, last month was individual financial planning. I can't believe it's February already. This month is Small Business Month. Next month we go into the what ifs. What if a catastrophic event happens? How do you prepare for the event when you don't know that it's necessarily coming? And there are some basics there that we'll be talking about. So if you know someone, we have a couple of guests lined up already. In fact, three different guests who are going to be coming in over the next 6 to 8 weeks. Please let us know at llexo, L-L-E-X-O-W, at nickelfinancial.com, or John Graney at jgraney, J-G-R-A-N-E-Y, at nickelfinancial.com. Thanks to Steve and Daryl here at WSIE-FM 88.7, The Sound, bringing you jazz, talk, and all kinds of great programs for your listening pleasure. So, having gotten that out of the way, thanks to Chef Shop again, too. Nancy was great. I loved having her in here. Chef Shop located at 2320 Troy Road in Edwardsville, of course, in the Schnucks Plaza right next to Target's. Phone number 618-659-9840. Go in there. Remember, if you go in, tell them you heard the show, you will be eligible to receive a free T-shirt. And I do know for a fact they have free fudge samples, so I have partaken of that occasionally. So it's a good reason, if nothing else, you get a T-shirt and some fudge, you know. Just don't use the T-shirt to wipe your fingers, but that's okay. All right, I'm done.
Hi, folks. We're back. Hello, is this thing on? Yes, today's topics. For the In the Market segment, I'm going to talk about active versus passive bond management, and I'll get into why we're going to do that. The topic of the week is we're going to do a little role playing today.
I like playing roles.
I'm going to be
like eating roles too.
Not the food. I'm going to be a prospective client, business owner, small business owner. It is Small Business Month, and I need to set up a retirement plan for my employees. Larry is going to be the esteemed expert in setting up the appropriate retirement plan, and hopefully through this process, you'll get a better understanding and maybe look at your situation. If you're a business owner and you have a retirement plan, maybe it's not the right one. Or if you don't have a retirement plan, maybe help you get one set up. Larry, I think, beat me last week with the story of the week.
You mean the story of the weed?
The story of the week. Exactly. Oh, you are.
I'm on it today.
You've had your coffee.
I'm telling you, it's good coffee too.
But I don't think he's going to get me this time. I have one that I laughed, I cried. It became part of me. So
I got another crazy criminal story today. So we'll see how that goes.
There's a theme here.
I know.
So looking at bond funds, why is this topic a hot topic right now? Well, the Fed last year at the end of the year started to raise interest rates. When rates go up, bond prices go down. There is what we call an inverse relationship between rates and bonds, and it's a very simple calculation.
It's kind of like I was taught, John. You know, it's the old seesaw.
Yep.
You know, when one goes up, the other goes down.
So if you look at it as a simple fraction, if your denominator gets bigger, your numerator or the top number gets smaller. So that's exactly what's happening when rates go up. So there's a lot of clamoring now, a lot of discussion that, you know what, you should have active bond management. What that means is you are paying a portfolio manager to manage this specific portfolio, and we'll look at intermediate term corporate bonds for the sake of our discussion. They will be responsible for buying and selling the bonds that they want in their portfolio, and their goal is to outperform a benchmark or an index. So, you know, in this situation, there may be arguments for the fact that an active manager can position a portfolio, whereas a passive manager just follows the index. Now, a bond index is a lot more difficult to mirror than a stock index. If you look at the S&P 500, there's only, you know, call it around 500 companies that are in that index, and the manager can go out and buy those stocks and be able to track the index pretty closely. You know, there could be over 9,000 bonds for a given category, and that's very difficult and cost ineffective to exactly mirror that index. So they do the best that they can to get what we call a nice tracking error relative to that index. But does a rising rate environment really make sense to go ahead and switch over to an active manager? And I'm not sure. You know, I looked at the data. I looked at several different articles, and it's kind of interesting. You know, I had an article from one active management company that obviously was supporting their approach, and I have another article from a more passive investment company. And of course, their argument is, no, it doesn't make sense. So let's look at some of the numbers.
It's kind of like a belt and suspenders.
Okay.
Well, you know, the belt is for most of us, holds the pants up fine. But if you're a little unsure, you know, maybe you need to consider some active management and put on a pair of suspenders.
Okay. On that note, I don't need to say anything else then.
I wouldn't.
What I have here is I have two funds. One is a Vanguard Intermediate Term Corporate Bond Fund, which is passive. So they're trying to mirror the Intermediate Term Corporate Index. And then I have the PIMCO Total Return, which is an active management fund for basically intermediate term bonds. And given the fact that we are up until December of this past year, we were not in a rising rate environment, the index fund has outperformed the PIMCO, the active management fund, quite significantly over the past 5 years or so. Unfortunately, one of the funds doesn't, the Vanguard doesn't have a 10-year number, so it's kind of hard to tell how that will perform. But, I mean, if you look at the historical 5-year average, it's 4.54, positive 4.54% for the index fund versus 2.81% for the PIMCO Total Return or the active management fund. That's in a 5-year average.
So about double, or not quite, but pretty close to double.
And if you look at the 3-year, it's 4.51 versus 2.26. And the 1-year was 5.3 for the Vanguard, 5.3% return versus 2.20.
Past performance is not an indicator of future results, John.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have a rising rate environment, so we will see what happens. But over the past 3 months, which ended December, the PIMCO Total Return outperformed. It was down 2.5% versus down 3.39% for the Vanguard. So does this warrant taking a different approach to your bond management portfolio? And everyone, I mean, as much as we in the industry like to think that investing is a science, over my 20 plus years of doing this, I think it's equally art as it is science. You got to do what's right for you, what you feel comfortable with. And one, I highlighted this part of the article. The difficult part of active management, they're saying that it's a zero-sum game. So in order to have a winner, you have to have a loser. But in reality, investors are exposed to costs such as commissions, management fees, bid-ask spreads, administrative costs, market impact, taxes, and so forth. As a result, after all the costs are considered, you're looking at, for a corporate bond fund, the active management fee is 56 basis points. That's the average. The Vanguard ETF or corporate bond fund that I'm looking at has a 7 basis point. So much less expensive than the average, where the PIMCO total return actually was closer to 85 basis points.
So you're going to add an extra 0.5% in terms of, or subtract an extra 0.5% in terms of cost on active versus passive.
Correct. And that makes a tough hurdle for a bond manager when you don't really have a whole lot of return, you know, huge returns to overcome that cost. You know, for me, for my approach, with rising rates, you're better off shortening the length of your, what we call duration, or the length, the term of the bond. So instead of having a 5-year average maturity, meaning that you've lent some company money for 5 years, you may do a 12-month, 18-month, 24-month type of portfolio, much shorter. The reason being is the portfolio will turn over and the new money will be invested in the higher rate should rates go up.
And rates will go up.
They will go up. However, knowing exactly when is another cog in this decision. I, you know, Larry and I had mentioned at the end of last year, we weren't sure that we were going to see 3 rate increases this year, which is what the Fed was saying that they were thinking about doing. We may. I just don't see it right now because the growth number, the GDP growth numbers that came out weren't very strong, and you really can't raise rates. So that gets into market timing. If you're trying to time when the Fed's going to raise rates, it may not work out well for you.
Let's go back to basics, John, because the type of bond, everyone, I'll make a general statement. You can agree or disagree.
I disagree.
Everyone needs to have some component of safety or some component of income producing bonds, stable value funds in their portfolio. That leads us to a properly diversified portfolio. So we're all going to have a bond component. Question is, what kind of bonds? I know with a lot of my older, don't go there, a lot of my older clients, they have individual issues, and not those kind of issues, but individual bond issues that they have purchased maybe, who knows, 5, 10 years or longer, where they have a laddered portfolio or they own an individual bond, whether it is municipal, government, or corporate. And keep in mind that if you bought a bond for, let's say, $1,000 or $10,000, and it has an interest rate of 4% over the lifetime of the bond, it will continue to pay you 4% over the lifetime of the bond, regardless of what general interest rates do. And upon maturity, as long as the issuer doesn't default, you will get all of your money back. So those of you who have individual issues, bonds that you've held and continue to hold at a reasonable rate, don't worry about interest rates going up on those individual issues, because they won't change unless you go to sell your bond before maturity, and then you're going to be subject to whatever rates have done over that period of time. Next, it takes us to, okay, is it a good idea to own individual bonds? And I guess that's a retrospective question, in that if you bought bonds and they were paying 4, 5, 6, 7, 8%, and you've locked in for 5, 10, or 20 years, good for you. you guessed that one right, but because that's, you know, you're solid. It's kind of like a CD in terms of return. You know what you're going to get, as long as, again, the underlying issue doesn't go bankrupt. You're good to go. But most of us don't have that anymore, especially in today's environment, don't have that option. So we go to bond funds. And
the cost of buying individual bonds will kill you unless you have a very sizable amount of money to invest, because you're not going to get favorable pricing.
That is true.
And it's hard, and it's more on the sell side of the equation, but it's hard to tell exactly how much you're paying for a bond, because they change the pricing and you don't know what someone else is getting, such as an institutional investor who goes in with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars as opposed to your 10,000,
yeah,
whatever it may be.
Exactly. And that takes us back to our fifth step of our financial plan. You know, specific time frames, objectives, it has to be in writing, you have to implement, and you have to monitor it. And that's the environment we're in, is monitoring, as John indicated, with shorter duration bonds, whether it's 6 month, 12 month, 18, 24, 36. Let's see where this thing goes. You monitor, you make changes along the way and adjust, and that's how you can determine your success. You know, if you're in undecided, then maybe you move a little bit over to active instead of passive bond funds. But we don't know the answer to that. If we did, we'd be doing it.
I think the conclusion here is neither passive nor active bond strategies, no matter what type of investment portfolio that you're using, are inherently dangerous or without risk. What makes an investment dangerous is not knowing those risks. You want to make sure that you understand the makeup of your investment portfolio, how the portfolio is being managed, and adjusting to market moves, as well as, you know, the overall rate environment. We are a very low interest rate environment, but we certainly have the possibility of rates going up. You know, my approach would be, if I had the Vanguard intermediate term whatever portfolio, would be to take some of that money and buy the Vanguard short term whatever portfolio. And now you've positioned yourself and your portfolio to be a little more stable, a little more predictable in a rising rate environment.
No question about that. And it brings up.
And I mean, again, if you don't want to be bothered doing that, then go ahead and get an active manager. But make sure that you're getting one that doesn't have outrageous fees and so forth for you to for that manager to have to overcome to track against an index and make your return meaningful.
And if all of this makes your head spin, as I know it does in some cases, I have some clients, and particularly, God love them, you know, particularly my older clients, and I'm talking upper 80s, 90s. I have a number of those folks who I work with, and they just want to know the bottom line. They don't care about active or passive or short-term or intermediate-term or whatnot. So find a trusted advisor, someone you feel you can.
What have you done for me lately?
Find a trusted advisor you feel you can trust, who has a good record in helping you meet. Because I love the call I get periodically, and it's just a good opportunity to talk to our client on a regular basis. But she calls, and you know, we started with a $100,000 portfolio, and that's pretty much all the money she has besides Social Security that comes in, and she's doing okay. But she calls me periodically, and she's like, "Well, how are we doing? And you know, I really haven't made much money. I started with $100,000, and it's at 101. And you know, I just wanted to check in and see how things were doing." And she neglects to account for the fact that we've been taking, you know, about $2,000 a month out of the portfolio. So she's taken out $24,000, but we're only up one. So you know, it takes client management.
Education.
So
education,
and you know, she loves spending the monthly income, but she doesn't necessarily relate that to earnings on her portfolio. So if you're not comfortable, ask questions. Find someone who's willing to take the time and effort to explain it, and maybe even bring in a sibling or daughter, son, whoever is working with a parent particularly, to make sure that everybody understands what they're doing. So,
absolutely. And if you have questions, you're not sure, feel free to email us or go onto our webpage to get our email information, and that's www.thefinancialcafe.us. And our Larry's information and my information is out there. And you shoot us your question, your concern, your comment, and we will be glad to talk about it on the next show. So that wraps up the In the Market segment, and we're going to go into the topic of the week, which is, what is the best retirement plan for a small business owner? So I'm going to be a business owner. I have 15 employees.
You are a business owner.
I am a business owner, but I don't have 15 employees, so we're gonna have a little pretend thing going on here. I have 15 employees. I do have a concern. I would like to be able to help my employees prepare for retirement. So I do want that aspect of it. However, you know, I have some cash flow concerns. I don't want to strap the company, because if I don't have a company, then they don't have a retirement plan. I mean, I've heard about 401ks. I understand, you know, a little bit about what they are. In a prior life, I had one. I'm not sure how expensive they are, if it's even the right thing. So I just walked into Larry's office, and he sat me down.
I gave him a cup of coffee also.
And I had one with me. That's just how I roll. But So I am sitting down, and we will begin the role-playing interview because the esteemed, knowledgeable 401k retirement plan expert, Larry Alexo, is going to gather the data to make his recommendation to me.
And John, as you well know, I could do this in my sleep.
No.
Only done it a couple of thousand times. John, I'm glad you came in today so we have an opportunity to talk about your company, your future needs, goals, objectives. Obviously, you've been thinking about retirement or we wouldn't be sitting here. So tell me a little bit more about your company. How long has it been in existence? Your employees, do you have a lot of employees who have longevity or is there a lot of movement in employees, that type of thing?
Well, all my employees love me dearly. So I don't have much in the way of turnover. I even choked myself up on that one.
Mm-hmm.
It's a young, I think I'm the oldest and I am old. I'm under 50, so we'll leave it at that. Not for much longer though. So I am the oldest employee, if you will, and the employees have been asking about something to save for retirement. One of my big concerns is I know the competition out there does offer a 401k plan, my strongest competitor, and I don't want them taking some of my employees because of that. So I want to make sure we set up the right plan and do right by the employees, but at the same time not put me in a financial situation where I all of a sudden committed something that I can't afford to do in a given year that may not be as bad. My business is I provide widgets to potential widget buyers.
Lots of widgets out there, John.
Mm-hmm. Not like my widget, though.
Yeah, I get that. Not an unusual situation. Conversation I have had and continue to have many, 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 many times. The real question, the answer to your question, what type of plan should I set up, is it depends. And it depends on a lot of things. So what I like to do is take clients through a process. And the process is, first, how much money do you think you may and your employees may want to put away annually, particularly on a pre-tax basis, so they're saving federal and state tax on their contribution?
Well, I mean, of course, my employees are saying that they want to save the max. I'm not sure that they understand the impact that will have for them on a week-to-week, month-to-month basis. So I would want some flexibility in mm-hmm. the contribution part of it. From my standpoint, I could probably handle contributing $25,000 to $50,000 a year on their behalf. And still feel comfortable about cash flow.
That's a great place to start. And occasionally, if I'm working with an employer who really has a need in their mind but doesn't really know what their employees need, is I may recommend doing a survey. We will provide them with a survey to submit to the employees to talk about what they're willing to put away. I'll even go out and do a meeting with the employees to talk about it, because the individual retirement account, the IRA account contribution limit in 2017 is $5,500. If you have a lot of employees, which are lower wage, let's say they're making $20,000 a year, are they going to be willing to put in more than 25% of what they're earning? It's a lot. It may not be a lot more than what they need to be putting in, but it is a lot. And the question, depending on their age, depending on are they married, do they have a family, et cetera, we don't know the answer. We can't predict that. But we could do a survey and find out what they want to put in. We can point out the fact if they do put the $5,500 in, if they're only earning $20,000, then they're really going to be only saving maybe $1,500 in taxes. So it's a good savings, but it's not significant. The one thing we may want to consider for them is the fact that if they do make a contribution, there is a savers credit for those earning below specific wage limits. So that for every dollar they put in, they will get a 50% tax credit on their money. So all of a sudden, the government's allowing them to take a tax credit. So it's that much more money that they would have put in towards retirement and tax savings than otherwise. So on the low end, if $5,500 or for an individual 50 or older with a catch-up of $1,000, $6,500 a year is about all that everybody can manage, then let's set up some IRAs. It could be payroll deduction IRAs. It could be
now. Is this a variety. Someone? You know, one of my friends has said that. Oh, you need a SEP IRA. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yes and no.
Do you ever give a straight answer?
Sometimes. Sometimes. It's a good segue, though. A SEP IRA is a little different. Any employer can establish a SEP IRA. The employees who are eligible, anyone can do an IRA that has earned income. Let's start there.
Okay.
So anyone who has earned income, they have a W-2, they can do an IRA up to the $5,500 or $6,500 amount per year. Take the savers credit if they're eligible with their wage, their adjusted gross income. And that's pretty much their money. They can invest it and do with what they want. Now, on another show, we'll talk about maybe best way to invest that. But on a SEP IRA, that's something an employer can set up. We do see a few of those, not many, do see a few of those. any employer can set that up. As far as eligibility, any employee who has been employed in 3 of the last 5 years and is 21 years old and has earned at least $600. So we have a couple of parameters there. 3 out of the last 5 years, at least $600 earning and 21 years old would be eligible.
Well, all my employees really love me, and they've been with me now for over 5 years.
Well, I can only imagine that. They're on a SEP IRA. There are no filing requirements as such. There are.
Now, when you say, is that the administration part? Because the person that told me I should do a SEP is, he said, don't do a 401k because there are a lot of expenses on the administrative side.
It's a common misconception that
I never thought he was the smartest guy in the world. Anyway,
well, obviously he's a friend, so that's a common misconception. The SEP IRA, interestingly enough, is only employer money. So if you want to put your 25 to 50 grand away and you want to put an equal percentage in for all of your employees, for example, our $20,000 employee, let's say you decide to put 10% in for everyone, then you're going to put 2 grand in for him. And if you have 15 employees and you put 2 grand in for everybody, there's your 30 grand. It's right in the middle of your sweet spot, so to speak.
But they, the employee in that situation, they're not contributing.
They cannot, not into a SEP IRA. Not into a SEP IRA.
Can they do the regular IRA while doing the SEP, or is that prohibited?
They can. Yeah, they could do okay. The $5,500 into their own IRA out of their paycheck.
Now they're going to have 2 accounts and that kind of dip.
You would have 2 accounts and okay. Can confuse things. I would be aware of account charges and fees and whatnot doing that. But SEP IRA, when I go into a company and they're like, oh, we have a SEP IRA and we do 15% every year, and that really is wonderful, but they're putting a lot of money in for the employees that they may or may not otherwise have to as we get into some of the other plan designs. So So we have a basic IRA. We have a SEP IRA, which is employer-only funded. Again, don't see too many of those anymore, although the employer can put in up to 25% of an individual's compensation into the plan. So if you were making $100,000 a year, you could put $25,000 in for yourself as an employer contribution, but you still get no tax savings because it's an employer contribution.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure if that works out for me because now there's 2 accounts. They're saving on their own versus, having an account where all the money is going in, and I can, it will help me convey, how much I care about my employees. I'm not sure that the SEP is going to work for me.
Well,
what else is there?
And that's a good point. I remember when my wife first went to work many, many, many years ago. Careful. Okay, one less many. She was a participant in a SEP IRA that her employer, she worked for a doctor, that he set up, and he put money in every year. She got a contribution statement in every year, and until she quit, she had really no idea what she had or what it was or how it worked or anything else. So it's not really one that many employees go, yeah, my employer is putting money in for me, because they just don't. So
okay.
If we move on from the SEP IRA, we can look at a simple IRA, and a simple IRA.
There's a lot of different IRAs.
There are a lot of IRAs. This is supposedly a simple IRA. In some ways it is, in some ways it isn't. The simple IRA allows a business owner to set up a plan It has to be a calendar year plan, and it can only be for up to 100 employees. You have 15, so I think we got a little growing room there. Any employee who has earned at least $5,000 in the prior 2 years and is expected to earn at least $5,000 in the current year is eligible. So it's based on earnings. So if you have employees and they earn $5,000 in the last two, and you expect them to earn $5,000 this year, they're in.
All right.
The deadline is you can establish a SEP IRA between January and October 1st of any calendar year. After October, you can no longer do it for that year. You have to wait until the next year. So we start there. There are annual notices that have to be given. There are accounts that have to be set up for each of the participants because it is an IRA account. It is 100% vested. So when the money goes in, it's their money. And I unfortunately have seen employers where they put the money into a SEP IRA account for their employees, and a couple of days later, the employee's already taken it out, paid the fine, you know, the penalty, 10%, paid the tax, and said thank you.
So well, I don't kinda, want that.
Kind of defeats the purpose. The pre-tax participant contribution limit is $12,500. So now we're double. You know, we went from $5,500 to $12,500 that the employee can put in. On a simple IRA, the employer must, and I categorize must, make a contribution every year. It's a dollar-for-dollar match up to 3% of compensation. So if a participant puts in 3%, as an employer, you have to put in 3%, and it is 100% vested. You can do 1 or 2% in no more than two of every 5 years. So if you get audited, I hope you have good documentation as to how you tracked when you did what percentage.
I was just about ready to ask. It sounds like a lot of work. Am I supposed to do all this?
You have to do all this because you don't have anyone else helping you.
I'm setting up the IRA account for them. I'm writing up the notices. There's no one that I can delegate this to?
Maybe your accountant might. I'm sure they're going to charge you an hourly fee for doing it. And many accountants don't want to do it either because the rules are not necessarily simple. The documentation
is... But it's called simple.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's government work.
Okay.
I have another acronym for that, but nevertheless. There are requirements. You can't just arbitrarily set up the account, start making a contribution, forget about it. You have to give annual notices. You have to have documentation in your file proving that you brought everybody in who was eligible when they were eligible and made the appropriate contribution. You can also put in a combined maximum contribution of $25,000. So if, for example, you earned $100,000 and you put in the maximum $12,500, then the employer could match 3% of what you put in. So they'd only put in another $3,000, you know, so you'd be at $15,500. So you'd have to have a pretty good salary to get up to the $25,000. Limit.
Okay.
But this is all stuff that if you get audited, you've taken a deduction, you better have good documentation because otherwise the IRS could void everything you've done and then you get to pay taxes on all of it.
Yeah, boy, I don't know if this one works for me. I don't want that kind of responsibility. I mean, it's hard enough running a business and it doesn't sound very flexible. I mean, I have to. So if I have a tough year and my widgets don't sell like the widget should, it puts me in a pickle.
You may have some pickles, but you still have to make a contribution. So that's a lot of people don't understand on a simple, you have to make a contribution of some type. And in addition to that, if you have a really, really good year, you cannot do anything else. So you're stuck. You put in the 100% of the first 3%, or we didn't talk about, you could just put in 2% of everybody's compensation, whether they defer or not. But at that, you're done. You cannot do any other employer contribution. So if you have a good year and you said, hey, Larry, I've got, I think I can put in an extra $50,000 in my retirement plan. Well, you're not going to be able to do it on a simple. The other caveat, which many people don't understand, in any calendar year where you have implemented a simple IRA, you cannot have any other type of qualified plan. And this occurred back last September, October. We had several plans that had simples, and they had grown to the point they wanted to put additional employer money in. So we had to terminate the simple, and that has to be done with proper notice to the employees in advance of the end of the year. and terminate the simple as of December 31st and started a new plan as of January 1, because you cannot have a simple and any other plan in any calendar year. So a lot of organizations don't understand the restrictions that you run into there. So,
well, that's a stupidly named plan. That's all I can say, because it doesn't sound very simple for a business owner.
It's a not simple, not so simple plan.
Okay.
Not so simple
IRA.
What
else you got?
All right. So from there, my favorite, for many reasons, the 401k plan. 401k refers to the Internal Revenue Code, the IRC section 401k, which allowed us back in 1981 to develop the ability for participants to put money into a retirement plan. Before 1981, any contribution that went into a retirement plan was strictly employer funded, whether it was a defined benefit, which many of which have gone away, or it was a defined contribution plan, a profit-sharing money purchase, target benefit, many of which you won't even hear about anymore, but were available then. They were all employer funded exclusively. The employee could not put any money away until 1981, when the 401k provision was implemented in the code and the participants started putting money into 401k plans. So they started out, a couple of misconceptions we began to talk about. 401ks are not, in my opinion, expensive. I talked to a lot of employers. They're like, oh, yeah, we considered a 401k. And my question is, well, when was that? Oh, it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago or whatever. And they may have been given bad information. They may have been given inaccurate information. But as they relate it to me, the information that they have is just wrong. They expect it to be very expensive. So I'll touch on that. Typically, there are three parties involved in addition to the plan sponsor. So as an employer, you are the plan sponsor for the 401k retirement plan. There are three other components. There is a TPA, or third-party administrator. The TPA is the one who takes care of all the paperwork and keeps you on track in terms of filings, notices, testing, any of the required components to make sure that the plan maintains its tax-qualified status in the eyes of the IRS and the Department of Labor.
So that's I don't have to do any of that then?
You don't have to do any of that.
Okay.
So, and we have a TPA firm. It just happens to be BCL Retirement Services. And we take on the role of the TPA and handle all of the paperwork, testing, and related filings, answer questions, distributions, loans, quadros, for those of you who don't know, it's qualified domestic relation order, which is issued in the event of a divorce. So the TPA has certain functions.
Okay.
The advisor, which is the individual who manages the assets and assists your employees in the selection of a diversified portfolio and assists the trustee in selecting the appropriate assets and the costs related, is an active part of the equation. So we have a TPA, we have an advisor, we have a plan sponsor, and last but not least, we have the investment company that provides the investment vehicle. So there really are four components to any qualified plan, but specifically in a 401k, the TPA is the administrative arm, the advisor handles the investments, plan sponsor obviously is the employer, and the investment company is whoever you decide to invest the money with in that plan.
Now, do I have to open up these accounts? I mean, when you talked about the simple, that really made me nervous. I don't want to be bothering opening up accounts and not have that responsibility.
Yeah, the simple is all about you, John. The simple is all about you. You need to do it. You may have an advisor helping you. If he knows what he or she knows what they're doing, that's great. But if he or she makes a mistake, it's your problem, not theirs. So just remember, it is all about you. On a 401k plan, the third-party administrator and the advisor work together to make sure that all of the employees are enrolled at an appropriate time frame, that they fill out the appropriate paperwork and it is complete and accurate, that the account is set up with the investment company after the selection has been made, and the participants are given education to meet all of the requirements of the Department of Labor 401k. So let's talk about the advantages. The 401k typically, for 15 employees, you're looking at less than, $100, $125 a month is your total cost for everything involved as far as the third-party administration, all of the documentation, the administrative issues and whatnot. So, you know, call it $1,500 a year or less. That is a good question. Under the law, typically, I'd say 90% of the time, the employer writes a check. That's an accounting payment. It's fully deductible. So typically at the end of the year or throughout the year, monthly, quarterly, whatever, the employer writes a check for the administrative fee, and that is not a burden put upon the employees.
Okay.
However, by law, they can deduct it from the employee's accounts. So if you have a plan and it has sufficient assets and you want to deduct that and let the employees pay for the privilege of having a retirement plan, you can. That is very unusual. I only find that in a few cases.
So, well, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to help them and set this up and then turn around and put that on them. That doesn't seem right to me. So I can handle that. Okay, so what else?
Yeah, it's typically a lot less than you're already paying for your accounting or payroll functions. So third-party administration is very economical in a small plan. If we had a plan, say, under five employees, total cost for a year would be under $1,000.
Okay.
So it becomes very cost-effective.
All right.
As we get into it, that includes doing the what we call adoption agreement or trust document, because a 401k is a trust account. The assets are held on behalf of the participants in trust until such point they meet a distributable event. The nice thing is you have some selection as to who becomes eligible for the plan. So we start talking about the choices that you have in a 401k that you don't have in any of the other types of plans. In a 401k, you decide when is an employee going to become eligible. You can make, let's say, for example, John, we decide to set up your plan April 1st. And it can be set up any month of the year, but well, let's just pick April 1. We're going to start your plan April 1. In the adoption agreement, we can elect that any employee that you have as of April 1 is going to be eligible to join the plan.
Okay, that makes sense.
If we want. And then anyone hired after April 1 is going to be subject to the plan's eligibility requirement, which can be established. The most stringent eligibility is 1 year. And two, what we call 1 year and dual entry. So if you hired someone May 1st, they would have to be on board through May of 2018, and dual entry would be like January and July every 6 months. So they would come in and join the plan July 1 of 2018. So all of a sudden that person had to wait basically 15 months to get in the plan other than those who were there on April 1.
Well, do I have to be there? Strict about
you don't
it?
Have to.
Okay.
We can be as flexible as everyone joins the plan when they're hired.
Okay.
So if you hire a new employee, they're in
the
plan.
I mean, it's for them.
They're in the plan immediately. From an administrative standpoint, we often recommend to tie it to your eligibility for your health plan or possibly other benefits. Or if you have as some companies do, you have a probation period of 90 days, then let's make their eligibility 90 days. You know,
okay.
Because if you hire them now and they aren't there 60 days from now, do you really want to go through all of the paperwork and payroll and to get them in the plan? Then all of a sudden, a week later, they're gone. So, you know, 90 days to a year is your eligibility period that you can select. You can actually have people join the plan down to age 18 if you want, unlike the SEP. And some of the others where they have to be 21. So you have a range of age 18 up to age 21. If you have part-time or you have student employees, you can actually get them in the plan also. So once we have completed the adoption agreement, which is done by the third-party administrator and in association with the advisor, once the advisor has counseled you on your fiduciary duties and selected the appropriate investment, which is based on typically the amount of assets in the plan, if you're starting from scratch, you're really limited to a few providers that are willing to take on new plans and do it cost effectively.
Do I have to pick the investments?
You have to be involved in picking the investments. You do, with the counsel of a good advisor. That's why you pick a good advisor.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
And the advisor will explain the pros and the cons. And we set up a brand new plan. Well, we do it all the time, but we set one up this last January. It was a brand new plan. And we chose investments based on that, knowing that it'll grow and expand. But they went into a provider that was willing to allow a startup, you know, a plan with no money in it to get up and running at least. So
okay.
you pick the plan investments, the advisor and the TPA establish the plan, you do an enrollment meeting, and all of a sudden, after everyone's completed their documentation and elected what they want withheld from their check to go into the plan, that goes to payroll. Payroll implements it. These are all things that we follow up on as a third-party administrator to make sure that payroll does implement the deferral percentage, that it is accurate, and that the funds are being invested as the individual has designated.
Now, how do I put money into the plan for them?
You do the same. You can do it a couple of ways. If you pay yourself a W-2 wage, then you can elect to defer into the plan up to $18,000 if you are 49 years old or under, or $24,000 if you are 50 years old or older. Those are the general.
Now, what about my employees? How do I help them?
Your employees can put in the same amount. They can put in up to $18,000, up to 100% of their wage. So if you had someone, and I do see this occasionally where it is a second income, an individual, whether it's the man or the wife or the significant other, whichever, is earning, let's say, $30,000, and they want to put 18 of it into the plan because they can, that's okay. They can elect to have that amount divided by how many payroll periods they have, and that will be deferred directly into the plan. The employer withholds the money just like taxes, payroll taxes are withheld, and they have 7 working days to make the contribution into the investment that's been chosen by the participant.
Okay, so do I, as the owner of the company, make any contributions for the employees? Because that's what I have that wiggle room, $25,000 to $50,000 that I would like to reward my employees.
Glad you asked that question, John.
Okay.
Because once we have a plan established, and I will say for a smaller company who doesn't have the flexibility of putting in an employer contribution, you can still have a 401k plan and allow your employees to put in up to the $18,000 or $24,000 without the employer having to put money in. But let's say you do want to put money in. So now you start making selections. The amount that the owners, we have two classifications in a 401k plan. We have, and government loves acronyms, the HCEs, or highly compensated employees, are defined as anyone who is a 5% or more stock owner in the plan, or anyone who earns above the taxable wage base, which last year was 118,000 something. This year, I think it went up to 123,000 or so. But we would determine that as a third-party administrator if you are an HCE. There's also something called family attribution. John, if your wife is involved or your children are involved in the company, then they are considered highly compensated, even if they're only making minimum wage, because they happen to be related to you through family attribution. So if you just do a straightforward 401k plan, then we have to do what's called testing. We have the actual deferral percentage, or ADP test. We also have the actual contribution percentage, or ACP test. You don't have to worry about any of that. We take care of it all for you.
Okay.
But at the end of the year, we have to calculate how much is the average contribution of all highly compensated employees, including you, your spouse, your kids, anyone else who owns 5% more of the stock of the company or who earns above the taxable wage base. Their average, in general, I'm speaking, general terms here, can be no more than 2% above the average of all of the non-highly compensated employees. So anyone who is not an HCE is a non-highly compensated employee, and their average can be no more or no less than 2% less than what you put in. So if the employer says, or if someone comes to me and says, well, I have a plan, but I get money back every year, I can't put as much in as I want. Well, isn't there a way around that? Yes. The answer is the government, in their wisdom, gave us a way of getting around that through safe harbor provisions. We love 401k plans with safe harbor provisions. We counsel the employer on selecting them. John, if you are willing to put a contribution in, then we would advise you to put in, for example, 3%. Sounds familiar from the old SEP IRA? If you would put in a 3% contribution for all of your employees, which is versus the 2% under SEP IRA, so it's only 1% more, then we don't care about testing. Then the HCEs can put in the maximum $18,000 or $24,000. So if it's you, your wife, and two kids, basically you can put in $96,000 on a pre-tax basis and not worry about what any of the other employees are putting into the plan. If it's only you and a partner, that's okay. You can each do the $18,000 or $24,000. If you don't want to do just 3% straight across the board, you want to incent your employees to contribute to the plan, then you simply do a match, which is called a traditional safe harbor match, and you match 100% of the first 3%. Again, that's the same as a simple IRA. You match 100% of the first three, and then you match 50% of the next two, which basically if the employee puts in 5%, you put in 4%. So your maximum contribution limit for the year is 4% of comp if everyone did five or more. It's a lot of numbers. It sounds complicated. It really isn't, particularly if you do this every day.
Now, what happens in a year where my widgets don't sell?
Well, if you don't sell widgets and you decide we can do on a year-to-year basis a couple of things. One, we can do a safe harbor maybe. So for 2018, for example, you have to elect this at the beginning of the year. So it's too late for 2017, but in 2018, you wanted to do a safe harbor maybe. Then we give a notice to your employees saying at the end of the 2018 calendar year, the company may put in a 3% safe harbor contribution if we're having a good year. And if so, then we don't worry about testing for you and your family. You put in the 3%, you can do the 18 or 24, everybody else gets 3% of salary, and we call it a good year. And the year that you are having a good year, then in addition to the 3%, you can say, well, you know, 3% of my payroll is only $15,000. And you said, maybe I'd put in 30 to 50. So let's do a profit sharing contribution on top of that. So now we can calculate what would be the appropriate profit sharing contribution if your payroll is $500,000. And you said, let's do a 5% into the plan. That's another $25,000. And it could be allocated on a salary pro rata basis, which is a common way of doing it. So everybody gets the same percentage, the same 5%, including you. Or we can do integration, another technical term relating to Social Security. So if the owner is earning a lot more than a taxable wage base, they would get an additional contribution to the 5%. Or we can do a position-related, sometimes called cross-tested, or new comparability plan, where we set out groups. We say the owners are in group A, the supervisors are in group B, the salespeople are in group C, the support staff is in D, and everybody else is in group E. And we can actually allocate different percentages to the groups based on performance. So we have some flexibility. We have one industrial manufacturer who has hundreds of employees located in multiple states. And we actually, they put in a base contribution to the plan of 3 to 5%. And at the end of the year, they give maybe an additional 5 to 10% profit sharing contribution to the facilities who have exceeded their profit goals. So the employee at a facility who has exceeded profit goals might be getting the base contribution of 5%, maybe another 10. So all of a sudden they're getting 15% in addition to what they can defer into the plan.
There's, you know, I like that flexibility. That's a lot of different directions that I can go with this. I like the fact that I'm not tied to anyone. And if I want to do more, I can do more. And if I can't, I can't, you know. So I think that fits the bill.
That kind of sums it up. A lot of flexibility on a 401k plan. You need to work with someone who is a trusted and well-versed third-party administrator slash advisor, as we do in our firm, of course, have been doing for over, well, the firm's been around 54 years now, so we've had a little practice at this, thanks to my older brother, George, who started back in 1963. But we feel that if you're working with a qualified third-party administrator, you have an advisor who is willing to sign on as a fiduciary, we're back to that again, then you're going to be in pretty good shape, and you can put a lot of money away. A family, husband, wife, even just a husband and wife on a small 401k with a couple of employees, we can easily get them to the point that each one of them is contributing $54,000 into the plan. If they're over 50, it's going to bump up to $60,000. So they can make over $100,000 contribution to their 401k plan with a fairly nominal contribution to the other employees. Save a ton in taxes, and guess what? Prepare for retirement someday.
Okay.
That's my story. I'm sticking to it.
Well, folks, hopefully that helped. We went through a couple of the more common retirement plans. And hopefully, you know, going through that little role play there as business owners helped you understand what's out there, what you have, if you're looking to set one up. So that wraps up our topic of the week.
And I can do this into the strange, all day, John.
I noticed. The strange news stories and deeds. So I'm going to save mine. I'm going to have you go first, Larry, right. Because...
Well, last week we had the story of in Australia of the individual who was complaining about their pot dealer raising the prices.
Inflation.
I know.
Even
inflation
narcotics bad. Even are subject to inflation.
Even in Australia, narcotics are going up. So they called the police and reported the outrageous increase in pricing and didn't leave their name. I don't know why. But the police decided to put it out on Facebook that anyone who was being affected by the increase in prices for their pot and their narcotics, they ought to let the police know and they'd help them out. And they did help them out and in to jail. So this year, a little differently, still along a gambling theme, John, there was an individual, you know, the old story, Kenny Rogers, saying that a gambler needs to know when to hold him, know when to fold him. Well, he forgot to mention it's a good idea to leave the casino and not rob a bank. There was an individual who is now serving 5 to 18 years in prison, was 52 years old. He was in Charleston, West Virginia. Why is this always the East Coast, John? He was in West Virginia. He was playing gambling at Mardi Gras Casino in Nitro. He got up from the blackjack table. He put a $25 chip on his spot and asked him to hold it. He directly drove to a bank, went to a teller, said he had a bomb and a weapon, and he stole $5,000, turned around, drove back to the casino, and started betting it again. And needless to say, he lost more than the $5,000. So he's now in jail.
Wow.
Stupid criminals.
Yeah, so that's like Gamblers Anonymous.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, didn't work. Fun story. But it's not beating this one.
Okay.
Here's the heading. Tinder for apes. For those of you out there that don't know what Tinder is, it's an app where you can find a date.
Sure.
Okay. Both of us are married, so we obviously don't use that. But for
never heard of it.
For the singles people, this is an app that you go out and to get a date. In this case, though, in the Dutch orangutan test out computer dating. So they are creating a version of Tinder for orangutans. Now, I've been to the zoo here in St. Louis, very nice zoo. I didn't realize that there was a sexual problem for the apes. I have seen many strange things in my visits, and that never seemed to be an issue. But anyway, the biologists... his comment was, we want to help our animals and maybe other zoos' animals to make a choice.
Sure they do.
Said that animals have to like each other. I have never noticed that. I was thought it was more of a random thing, if you will. So yes, a Tinder app for orangutans, computer dating for apes.
I think I'll give you that one, John.
Yep. The only problem they have is... that they need to find out how to make the screen a little stronger because the male orangutans seem to be breaking the selection monitor, if you will.
Getting a little excited there, are we?
I wasn't going to go there,
yeah,
but...
Well.
So, yes, they keep destroying it, so that's their problem. Wow. I think I've seen it all now.
On that note, whether it's gambling or orangutans, we want to thank the Chef Shop.
Nancy, now they don't want to be part of this.
That's a segue. Yeah, can you believe that?
Nancy's not coming back again.
Nancy was in last week. We had a great time. Hope you caught the show. Go in and see him at the Chef Shop. Get some popcorn, some fudge, some coffee. Today is Christmas cookie. It's not Christmas, but I like Christmas cookie coffee. And that's what we're sampling today. It's really awesome. They're located at 2320 Troy Road in the plaza, Schnucks Plaza, next to Target, 618-659-9840. Thanks to both Scott and Nancy at the Chef Shop for underwriting the show and giving us the opportunity to share some financial information, hopefully a little education on retirement plans today, other topics coming up regarding small businesses, small business loans. If you have a small business, it's good information for you. If you don't, it's good information for you as to whether you really want to have one or not. So,
and if you're interested, if you are a business owner and interested in having us talk about your product or your company and you want to do some underwriting, it is very affordable, a very inexpensive way to do a little bit of advertising, if you will, underwriting. And you can reach us at www.thefinancialcafe.us. And then Larry's contact information, my contact information is out there. And feel free to give us a call and let us know. We will be glad to meet with you and try and get something set up.
John Graney and Larry Lexo at the Financial Cafe on WSIE-FM 88.7 The Sound. Thanks for listening. Hope we've shared a few things that were beneficial to you. And until the next time, say goodbye, John.
Goodbye, John.
You've been listening to The Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop in Edwardsville, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. Listeners are invited to send your questions regarding retirement, investments, or any other financial topic that may pique your interest. Send the questions to John at jgraney@nickelfinancial.com or to Larry at llexo@nickelfinancial.com. John and Larry will discuss those questions each week during their Q&A session. If you prefer, they will respond to you in private. Thanks for listening to The Financial Cafe on 88.7 WSIE The Sound.